Afternoon, everybody. This is Christina Zausner with CREPSI here in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us. And we wanted to bring you this complimentary call regarding Brexit as the events were unfolding in order to talk about the political, the economic, and operational aspects. This is planned as the first of a two-part series. The second will be held at K&L Gates offices in New York City. And we'd like to make this interactive. You can find a spot to send questions online. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Peter Cosmatatos, who's CREPSI Europe's CEO. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. And hello, everybody. I won't say good morning or good afternoon because I appreciate it's different for different people. So as Christina says, there's been an enormous amount written and said about Brexit and the implications of the vote that took most of us somewhat by surprise on the 23rd of June. What we thought was that this would be a good time, now that at least the first cloud of dust has settled, to try to take stock in a bit of an overview way, bringing in the political, the commercial, the economic, the legal, tying together these different perspectives. I'll allow each of the other two speakers that we have here in London to introduce themselves, and then I'll try and trot through a sort of 10-minute or so overview before we get stuck in. As Christina said, do please use the chat function on the web page to ask us questions. We'll get around to them a little bit later. We have an hour for the call. I think we can extend if we need to. And if people want to stay on. Andrew, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks, Peter. Hi, everyone. My name is Andrew Peterson. I'm a finance partner at K&L Gates here in London. I'm also a director of CREPSI, and I think it's incredibly important that you hear from CREPSI during this volatile and challenging times. I also serve on our Brexit European Advisory Group, which we set up at the beginning of this year because we anticipated that clearly, the referendum could go either way, but in the event that it did go this way, there was a lot of work that needed to be done from a European perspective. Obviously, we have offices both in the UK and in continental Europe, so it's challenging times, but I'm hoping that today we can get through some of the issues and let you know the way forward for certain issues that you might be thinking about. Mark?
I'm Mark Battistoni from Chatham Financial. For those of you who don't know Chatham, we are a financial risk management advisory firm, and our footprint is most prominent where capital markets such as debt, currencies, intersect with derivatives markets. And so, you know, for the past 14 years I've been in London, I'm an American historically, but a lot of interesting developments serving both borrowers, lenders, and some other clients. Focusing on financial risk management, I will say that look forward to questions on broader issues, but we are not an advisory firm which makes predictions, so we're not going to be able to share with you where the pound is going to go or where interest rates are going to go. But unless it's a question of that nature, look forward to participating in today's discussion.
Right. Thank you. Right. So Before the referendum in the UK, there was a regime in place, a regulatory statutory regime that meant that many business organisations were very reticent about expressing views on the referendum and what they wanted to see happening. There were special rules that meant that anybody spending more than a fairly small amount of money, or deemed to be spending more than a fairly small amount of money, £10,000. Was in promoting any particular outcome would be treated as campaigning. And that led to many organizations, including trade associations and including us, being very cautious about not being seen to campaign because of the implications of getting caught up in that regulatory framework. In some ways, looking back, I think that's unfortunate because after the referendum result, it seemed very clear that the overwhelming majority of views, not universal, but the overwhelming majority were very much hoping for a Remain result, and yet very few people took the opportunity to explain why and to discuss that when it could have made more difference. So how did we get here? A couple of years ago, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, promised that there would be a referendum after the election that happened in 2015 if he was in power. The broad consensus view is that the main driver for that was that Europe and the UK's relationship with the European Union has been something of a running sore within the Conservative Party for a very long time, within the broader political establishment as well, but especially within the Conservative Party. And the UK Independence Party, UKIP, led by a man called Nigel Farage, had been making steady inroads into the political landscape, including attracting certain Conservative MPs, members of Parliament, into its fold. So in some respects, the referendum was an attempt by a party leader to address party problems rather than a serious effort by a prime minister to tackle national issues. Clearly, there are national issues at stake, but it was largely driven, the timing and the reality of it, by party politics. As I say, I don't think many people expected that it would lead to a Leave vote. And anecdotally, a lot of people who voted Leave appear to have voted Leave in order to send a message, or voted Leave without the expectation that it would actually happen. But we are where we are. And where we are is actually very uncertain. The referendum has been widely said, on the one hand, by the supporters of the Leave camp to show that the people have spoken and have made a decision, and the political establishment is duty-bound to implement that decision. On the other hand, it is widely said to be purely advisory, because it does not itself represent a political decision. And some form of government decision, whether it's by Parliament or by the government and the Prime Minister using their prerogative as government, will need to be made in order to implement and give effect to the decision. And, of course, the logic of regarding the referendum as advisory is supplemented by the fact that there is no clear consensus around what exactly Leave means. And a lot of the discussion has been around what the processes and how the decisions would be made around the terms of the breakup, the departure of the UK from the European Union, the terms of trade the UK would have subsequently both with the remainder of the European Union, and there are a number of different models out there that would need to be negotiated, and indeed the terms of trade that the UK would have with other countries, which currently are to some extent covered by EU trade agreements. But in future would obviously need to be addressed at a national level by the UK. So there's a considerable amount of uncertainty in that area. And for me, actually, the single strongest message of where we are at the moment is that the uncertainty is really quite overwhelming and will take a long time to resolve. So we will see an enormous amount of volatility, markets going up, going down, people feeling optimistic, pessimistic, people seeing opportunities, people being overwhelmed by risk. It will take a long time before we really know where we are, I suspect, months at the very least, before we have any meaningful degree of clarity and certainty. In terms of the UK commercial real estate market, which is the most obvious initial focus for us, I think, the most obvious area of concern as a result of the vote was the London City office market. And the reason for that is that on leaving the European Union, it is not at all clear whether financial institutions, banks in particular, based in London, would retain the right to passport their services into the remainder of the EU. So the traditional practice for a lot of non-European firms, including North American firms, to set up their gateway office for Europe in London and trade into the UK from there, into the rest of the European Union from there, would be of uncertain effectiveness after a Brexit. And as I say, that remains uncertain. We don't know on what the terms of trade would be and whether financial institutions based here would be able to trade into the EU. And so there's concern around lower demand, falling rents in what is a very important and large, in value terms, component of the UK real estate market and of the investment portfolios of many large institutional investors in commercial real estate. In many ways, that concern has been dwarfed over the last literally 2 or 3 days by a degree of carnage and chaos in the open-ended retail commercial real estate funds sector in the UK. One fund managed by Standard Life Investments closed to redemptions on a temporary basis 2 days ago, saying that there was too much pressure from retail investors, ordinary retail investors wanting to take their money out, that would force it to make fire sale disposals that would not be in the interests of its remaining unit holders, and therefore they temporarily gated the fund. And for 24 hours or so, it looked like they were the only ones, although that felt rather implausible, and it must have been an uncomfortable position for them to be in. I think we're now at 9 or 10 different fund managers and somewhere between 10, 15, 20 plus billion pounds worth of commercial real estate assets that have been blocked to redemptions in this way and which are therefore subject to enormous pressure by those owners, albeit slightly deferred by the gating of those funds for sale. In terms of what the impact has been on values, the immediate reaction of many of the funds and many valuers after the referendum result was announced was to write down portfolios by, typically the number that was heard was around 5%. In the last day or so, larger numbers have been coming out of these open-ended retail funds of as much as 10, 15, 17% to try and discourage retail investors from taking their money out. And this is one of these things that there was, in my view, no need for this to happen, in the sense that, yes, there were certain challenges around what's UK growth going to do and what are the dynamics of the market going to look like. And perhaps the market was a little bit toppy and time was approaching for a correction in some parts of the market. But there was no need for any kind of panic or crisis. But unfortunately, these kinds of pressures from the retail market can become self-fulfilling in themselves. So we're in rather uncertain and potentially troubling territory at the moment. Interestingly, the Bank of England had flagged its concerns around the risk to open-ended retail funds in a financial stability report it published last December, long before anybody was really worrying about this in this context, and talked about it again in its latest financial stability report that came out just a few days ago. So that's sort of roughly at a very high level for now from me, the market reaction. So just to close, in terms of where we are politically, one of the major areas of uncertainty that we've experienced is complete chaos in terms of the leadership of our various political parties in the UK over the last couple of weeks. Two of the clearest voices in favour of the Leave result, Boris Johnson within the Conservative Party, who was expected, who was hotly expected to be the next leader in the event of a Leave decision, and Nigel Farage, the leader of the UKIP, single-issue party, in effect. Both of them stepped away and have retreated from the political battlefield, having apparently won the first, what can only be described as the first stage of what they were presumably seeking. In the aftermath of the referendum, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, announced that he would stand down, and the Conservative Party has today, just a few hours ago, finalised a shortlist of two candidates for the premiership who the expectation is will be put to the membership in a sort of primary style way, the membership of the Conservative Party, with a decision as to who the next Prime Minister will be emerging on September the 9th. Yeah. Both of those are women, which is interesting. And the first is the current Home Secretary. She's called Theresa May, and she is probably the favourite. And the second is called Andrea Leadsom, and she is currently the Energy Minister in the government. On the left-hand side of the political spectrum, we have the Labour Party, which is led by our version, rather less inspiring in some respects, of Bernie Sanders, who's called Jeremy Corbyn. He has very clearly lost the confidence, to the extent that he ever had it, of his parliamentary party. He had been elected to the leadership of his party by popular vote, rather than by the parliamentary party. He is refusing to stand down, and so there's a bit of a standoff and a bit of uncertainty over whether he will be, whether he can be, whether he will be toppled, and whether he'll be there to take the party into the next parliamentary election, whenever that may be. And then the centre, which is where the sort of the right wing of the Labour Party, as it were, where Tony Blair used to preside, and where we had another party that was in the previous coalition government up until 2015, the Liberal Democrats. They were pretty much wiped out in the last election. They only had 8 members of parliament left, and their leader most people probably couldn't name, although he is in fact called Tim Farron. So at the moment, we remain in very uncertain territory in terms of leadership, and we will only even know who the who will run the country for the opening stages of the debate about where the UK goes next in early September, mid-September. So the last point to make, and this will sort of segue into Andrew's next piece, is that the formal process for negotiating the breakup in the relationship between the UK and the European Union is the serving of a notice under Article 50 of which treaty, Lisbon, is it?
Treaty of the European Union, known as the Lisbon Treaty.
So-called Article 50 notice, which launches a 2-year negotiation period for the UK and the EU to agree terms of exit. And I think it's only after that that you agree the terms of engagement thereafter with the ongoing members of the European Union. So that's my overview. I'll hand over to Andrew to dive into the more legal effects.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I suspect a lot of people on this call would have found out about the Article 50 process, would never have really considered it before, but it is the mechanics upon which a member state can apply to leave the European Union. It's silent, really, on when it should be served. Peter mentioned the prospect of our new Prime Minister and whether or not the Prime Minister, through prerogative powers, can serve the notice or whether or not there is a UK Act of Parliament required. What's really interesting about the two candidates that we've discovered one of them will be the next Prime Minister, is that they both hold opposing views on when an Article 50 notice would be served. Theresa May has said that she would hold on and try and begin negotiations with the European Union, particularly on issues surrounding migration, to try and reach some kind of settlement, and she wants to have that. And she's also said she wants to hold on whether or not there's a decision to allow all those European migrants that currently are here legally and are working here to remain here. And so that's a real powerful card that she wants to keep in her back pocket. Leadsom, on the other hand, was part of the Leave campaign and has said that she would get on and serve the Article 50 notice as soon as possible. Why is this important? Well, it's important because Europe are demanding that the UK serve that notice as soon as possible. Europe is in self-preservation mode at the moment, as you can imagine. They do not want the contagion of a member state leaving to spread throughout the European Union, and there are certain other states that may follow the UK if the UK was to leave. And so in an out-is-out kind of mentality, the European Union is now saying that the UK needs to get on and serve the Article 50 notice, set the clock ticking, the 2-year clock that Peter mentioned, on the exit process. And only after that 2-year period has expired could they then start to negotiate with the EU for a framework agreement on the closeness of interaction going forwards, which seems completely nonsensical. I would hope that we'd get to a situation where, by just triggering the Article 50 notice, negotiations could then commence in a meaningful way, knowing that we've got a 2-year period to negotiate, such that we could try and understand what the deal is to us either leaving, what the leave plan is, whether or not that gives us access. Some people may have heard of the Norwegian model or the Switzerland model, but certainly gives us access to a single market going forwards, or perhaps gives us access through WTO rules surrounding trade and membership of the European Economic Area, which is basically the same as the European Union, but without having a seat at the table. So that doesn't seem quite attractive. What is an interesting development, which is arising over the last few days, is whether or not once that notice is served, such notice could be revoked. This is a very, very interesting question because it could lead to a stopping of the clock of the two-year period once the notice has been served. So we could serve the notice in the UK, encourage the European Union institutions to begin negotiations with us. They would do so, safing the belief that we had served the notice and there was certainty to exit. But at the same time, during that process, if we believed that it was in the UK's interest to stay in the EU, we could revoke or withdraw our withdrawal notice. It's a very interesting topic. There is no law on it. The Article 50 is silent on revocation. And so we are kicking that around as to what could happen in that scenario and whether or not there could be a challenge through the European institutions to us withdrawing our withdrawal notice. So as you can imagine, there is a lot going on at the moment. I think it's a very, very uncertain and volatile times, and in the questions that we'll go on to deal with, which we've noticed, is really dealing with values and what's going to happen to real estate both here in the UK and Europe and possibly in the US. We'll go on to deal with that. But with that, I'm willing to take any questions, and obviously on the process and Article 50, et cetera, during this call, but I'll just hand over to Mark as well to bring you up to speed on some of the economic changes or issues that we've faced since the referendum vote.
Sure. I will say just briefly that, you know, I'm not a commercial property expert, but it does seem pretty clear that if a lot of the bankers lose their office space here because of the lack of passporting that Peter mentioned earlier, there could be a need for a lot of legal minds to occupy those offices, and therefore it could dampen the actual shock to the London office market. There certainly will be a need for experts on negotiations during that process. I guess all I wanted to highlight, if as much time as I can, is that the currency markets and the interest rate markets are very important for a lot of international investors. And so from a U.S. perspective, that's something that tends to be on people's minds. Even if their ultimate concern is to understand the valuation of the property in U.S. dollar terms, it's going to be a function of currencies. If they're looking at investing, they're looking at interest rates as well. Those are often slightly different markets around the world. So a couple of obvious and non-obvious points to mention briefly on currencies and interest rates here for you. First is that, you know, the FX markets overall are quite large, and they've been functioning very well throughout this whole process. Clearly, there have been some sharp movements, but in case anyone was wondering if things are closed or shut or scary, the answer is no. But usually a concern for a commercial real estate professional is twofold. You have the spot rate, so what's the current market look like right now if you needed to exchange one currency for the other, and then the separate is a temporal issue of what if you wanted to lock in a rate for the sale that might be taking place in a few years' time. And that is the derivatives markets, which for currencies are very liquid, very deep, and still functioning perfectly well. A lot of volatility, that's clear, but absolutely no problems with the functioning of those markets. Another interesting aspect is that if you look at just a very narrow window of time since the beginning of June and in particular right after the election, the referendum itself, clearly there's a sharp fall in the value of the pound. But if you look back a little bit wider, even just to the beginning of the year, it's actually been a slide as opposed to, you know, just all of a sudden appearing from nowhere that the pound is devalued. And if you go back even further, I mean, I can recall in 2014, the FX rate for pounds to dollars was 1.7. So the difference between 1.7 and where it was, you know, just a month before the referendum took place, around 1.46, 1.5, that's a pretty big drop itself. We've just doubled the drop. So I think a lot of people can look at the FX market and go, oh, it's a panic, but it's been more of a medium-term phenomenon than a late-breaking story from that perspective. Another thing is that it's not just about the pound relative to the U.S. dollar. clearly the participants in this call may be interested in the U.S. dollar more than most, but it's a global phenomenon. And the actual largest fall for the pound to any currency of the majors during 2016 is actually versus the Japanese yen, down 25% since January 4th, the first market day of the year. So that's it's double the actual movement relative to the U.S. dollar. So that's a bit less of an obvious, but it still stares you in the face if you're looking at currency screens or the rates that are on the in the papers. And then the real kind of driver for that, is not always obvious, but it's often described as heavily linked towards uncertainty. Just as any asset will rise and fall with the certainty that's attached to its value, the uncertainty on the political front, on the economic front, and in particular, the time before more certainty will be arriving has a very punishing effect on those who sell or buy large amounts of currency. And it's large amounts of currency flows that really do dictate the great movements, the shifts, if you will, in FX markets. So some foreign investors will see this as a tremendous buying opportunity. That might be what is considered to be a break on the actual slump in the pound to many. I remember at the 2008-09 period where markets were going crazy all around the world in all sorts of asset classes, not just commercial property, but people were looking at optimistically having a V-shaped recovery. That could happen if the political situation meets expectations in terms of clarity, solidarity, and maybe a clever solution with negotiations. But this also could be an L-shaped, which, is a new paradigm of a low value to the pound for several years to come. I said before, Chatham doesn't guess or have forecasts of where interest rates or FX rates could go. But until that certainty is higher, it's probably going to be something either like an L in that the pound will stay low, or it can go up and down more like an extended version of a W. Which we've seen a little bit in the last few days. If you look at the intraday movements going up and down 1 or 2%, it might not seem large compared to a 10 or 15% shift, but 1 or 2% move in something as large as a currency can make a big deal. And lastly, just on the obvious points, investors are concerned about the values of their portfolios. They also might be concerned about the value of something that they're about to invest in, and the hedging markets are something a bit more of a longer period. Those markets are open, but they're just more difficult to use right now. The costs of hedging will go up in times of high volatility. There's some technical reasons for that to be the case. But even something as simple as a translation of one currency to the other, when markets are skittish or slightly illiquid, the slippage you pay versus the absolute bare minimum market rate at any point in time is higher. And that friction can be frustrating for anyone, no matter how large or small their portfolio or their risk they have before them. At that point, I can shift briefly to the interest rate markets. And just a high-level overview, the U.K. base rate is the equivalent of the Fed funds rate in the U.K., and that has stayed steadily at 50 basis points since early 2009. In the aftermath of this vote, the Bank of England stated very clearly or signaled very clearly that it's ready to ease that rate for the first time. It doesn't have much room to go before things are negative, but they're prepared to do that, and that has helped in some regards. But it hasn't helped the currency, because that also is a factor that leads to a declining currency. Mm-hmm. But now, in this very moment, since 2 weeks ago, it's the first time that a cut has been priced into the short-term market rates, which is the sterling LIBOR rate, since 2009. So this is unprecedented in terms of sentiment in that regard. And as a result, the entire interest rate curve, the whole term structure for sterling, is down substantially. So in the immediate term, if you again look at the narrow picture, it's down roughly 50 basis points, no matter where you look, whether it's a 5-year or 10-year rate, not in the very short end, but the slide is also something that's happened before the event. So it's down 100 basis points for the year. So it's, again, same theme. It's a continuation of a trend, and that might not be very obvious to those who are just looking at the news headlines. you know, the possibility of negative rates does exist in any currency. As we know, it's only in certain currencies around the world that does have, take place, but sterling is the closest it's ever been, and that has some knock-on effects for commercial real estate investors and borrowers as well. So I'll leave it at that for now to pass over back to Peter or Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think we wanted to emphasize, as Peter said at the top, that we want this call to be as interactive as possible. I think we set the scene for the political, legal, and economic landscape. But maybe if you can send in any questions that you have, maybe one of the first questions we actually had a question in advance, and I think this might be a good time to deal with it. Peter did mention values earlier as well, but we've had a couple of questions in which really questions whether or not we are seeing falling values, or what do we think will happen to CRE values, both here in the UK and in the US. My view in the UK at the moment is that we are really seeing a phenomenon that why buy today if you could buy cheaper tomorrow. And I think that is having an effect on values. One of the questions was, have we seen any observable data at the moment? Clearly, it's too soon to say yet. But I do know from real estate finance deals that we've been working on that valuations are proving very problematic at the moment, because which is different to the US, because you didn't have this in the US, but in the UK, the day after Brexit, all the valuers got together and, as one, put in their valuations a Brexit clause, which basically states that in the event that the UK does leave the euro, they do not really stand behind that valuation. So I think that's really causing a real concern as to where value is at the moment. Peter mentioned, obviously, the London office market. Clearly, that's been hit the hardest, I think. And I think JP did a recent report where they said that they believed that as regards to London offices, capital values in the West End, which is more of a fund environment compared to the financial district of Canary Wharf, but the West End values could fall by 30% over the next 3 years, and in the city and in the financial district of Canary Wharf, they could fall as much as 40% over the coming 3 years. So that was JP. UBS, in a research note, basically said that they are not rushing to make any decisions, but they did see a real issue for offices, particularly as we come to a landing on passporting, et cetera, and whether or not businesses would move outside of the UK and outside of the city. And at the moment, where would they move to? It's either Dublin, Amsterdam, or Frankfurt. Those seem to be the three leading cities that are on people's lists, not Luxembourg or Paris, funny enough, but that's where. And for CRE in the US, I just don't think it's being affected at the moment, although that's not to say that it can't get some contagion, depending on where the capital is coming from for those CRE assets. But I don't know, Peter, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think I can't comment on the how the US market would be affected. I think it's quite speculative, really. From here, it's hard enough to predict what's going to happen in our market here on the ground. And clearly, as Andrew suggests, there could be, you know, to the extent that international businesses want to avoid new or refreshed or enlaged property requirements in London or the UK, other cities around the European Union are likely to benefit. I suspect that it would be a dispersal. So rather than there being a single coherent financial centre, you would have a bit more going to Dublin, a bit more going to Frankfurt, a bit more going, you know, whichever other cities it is, rather than a different single centre emerging that takes over from London. I think that's much harder to imagine.
We haven't had the visit of the Dubliners yet, but the day after, on the Friday, a contingent from Frankfurt came to the city to start doing a roadshow for why move there, which I thought was quite interesting. They were already set up, and the website was set up with how to move to Frankfurt.
And there have been various stories about the French trying to roll out the red carpet as well for Paris. The one point I'd like to make is that from as far as the debt is concerned, we are in a very, very different place from where we were in 2007-08, in that there has been good discipline from the banks and other lenders, generally speaking, in their real estate, commercial real estate lending over the last few years. And the levels of leverage that you see in most of the commercial real estate owning businesses, the REITs and the funds and elsewhere, have been relatively sensible. Certainly the Bank of England as well has echoed, you know, I mentioned earlier that they've been harping on about their concerns around run risk in the retail and open, wider open-ended fund space. They have also been saying that they don't feel too worried about the risk within the banking system and the financial system, and I think that's fair. It's also notable that the last round, and I can't remember, I think it was probably around the end of last year, early this year, the last round of stress tests run for the UK banks by the Bank of England assumed quite dramatic falls in commercial real estate values. At levels that no one is currently, I think, anticipating, you know, sort of 30-40% in the near term, at least, based on the Brexit vote. So it doesn't feel this feels very different in that it doesn't feel likely that there'll be, you know, carnage in the banks, that there'll be fire selling because of over leverage. It's much more other issues. And aside from, I'm just thinking as well of another question. So somebody else has asked us to comment on sectors outside of financial services that are likely to have an impact on UK commercial real estate and which markets are likely to benefit in the short to medium term. I think all I can reasonably confidently say on that is that the bigger question posed by both the near-term uncertainty and the range of possible outcomes into which that uncertainty might resolve, generally speaking, the expectation is of slower growth, possibly some recessionary period, and a more negative outlook than we had for the UK economy. And inevitably, that affects kind of everything, right? It'll be the retail sector, it'll be values across the board, it'll be consumer spending, if employment and other things are hit. I don't think anyone's expecting a sort of Armageddon scenario, but the market had already been, long before this vote, I think from around last summer, autumn, the market was on a bit of a pause. And people were talking about the equity-driven part of the cycle roughly finishing and there being a bit of a debate about whether the debt would start fueling a further spurt of growth and yield compression.
Savills here in the UK had called the top of the investment market in September 14, right? So when people invested for income only and then saw a shift into long-term capital value plays, logistics, sheds, those type of things, that had been happening through 15. And I think, if anything, those are still popular, and it might be that you could point to those in the retail sector. I mean, Amazon just took a massive new letting in just outside of Edinburgh, right? Sheds are still being built for that last mile activity of getting Amazon goods to one's home. So I think that's still going on. Logistics, I think, are still going on, but, you know, it's very hard to see, you know, positiveness across the board. But bearing in mind that the Middle East money, the perhaps not the North American money, because I think North America paused on Europe, I think, but Middle Eastern money has just suddenly could come back in the far East Asian money could come back in, because that's just been now a significant discount just been introduced, right?
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that the equity markets across the board are actually doing fairly well. The resilience of equities means that if there's in my mind, again, I'm not an economics expert by trade, but the risk off in fixed income investors seems to have, you know, leaped from property to government bonds. So gilts being a store of value. instead of the actual bricks and mortar. Andrew Sentence, a former member of the Monetary Policy Committee, which is the equivalent of the Fed committee in the U.S., just mentioned on Twitter that it's fairly counterintuitive why people would be buying with reckless abandon UK gilts. The credit rating for the UK government's gone down.
Pricing's come in.
Exactly. So it's, in my view, a potential partial answer to the previous question is that if people are keeping their money in the UK and moving from property to gilts, that is not going to have any effect on the US market. If they're leaving the UK, period, as a risk, as a fixed income investor, and taking their money from sterling into dollars, and they park it in commercial real estate or other fixed income assets, then that will have a potential effect on pricing. But it's not clear as to whether there's that exodus from the fixed income market in the UK.
Just to pick up another question that's come in, which is what impact do we expect for the European, how do we think the European regulators, the European Central Bank, the securities markets, what are they, authority, ESMA, how do we think they will manage Brexit? Now, I'm not sure what legal role they have in managing Brexit, and I think, and I suspect actually the answer is very little. What I think is going to be more significant is that as the UK already loses influence in anything to do with financial regulation and input into financial market policy in Europe, and then in due course, assuming we do leave, as the UK stops having any influence in those areas within at the EU table, I think that will be, that presents real risks and problems because it is a significant loss of expertise and common sense and of a particular particular level of input and influence that even if we haven't felt we've had enough influence, I think the voice of the UK has been really important in those areas. There are no other countries that have anything like, I think, you know, there are a few that have some, but the degree of expertise in the UK is going to be a real loss when that is withdrawn from the European Commission, the ECB, the European Banking Authority, ESMA, and the like.
Yeah, and I think maybe we could mention something about CMU as well.
Yes,
capital markets. That's going to be a real blow, and I think we had a conference here yesterday where we talked briefly about CMU. This is a desire to have a single market, if you like, in for our capital markets, largely driven by the UK, it should be said, given the importance and priority of the City of London. The person in charge of driving that through, Jonathan Hill, resigned after the Brexit. He's been replaced by, is it a Slovakian?
No, a Lithuanian.
Lithuanian.
Dombrovskis.
That has said that he will carry on that work of driving through the capital markets union. But it's really hard to see how they will drive that through without the drive that the UK brought to that. And again, we don't have a commissioner to do that. What's really interesting about the CMU from a US audience is, you may have picked, some people on the call may have picked up on this, is that just before the vote, a rapporteur, which is a person responsible of producing reports for the European Commission, rapporteur called Paul Tang, an MEP, suggested that across the European capital markets, risk retention requirements should be increased from 5% to 20%. So he's produced a report that he thinks that should be across the board of the capital markets, and that was met with considerable
horror
and derision. And he did it. Attend the Global ABS, which is a global ABS conference in Barcelona in June, unfortunately held at the same in the same week as CREFC US, but he did attend to present his report and to justify why he thought 20% was a good idea. I just do not know where that is going to go, because clearly without the UK in Europe and without the capital markets, I mean, it might be that the US and the UK could do their own version of capital markets union going forward as well, and that's been put on the table as well. So there's a lot of discussion and work to be done on that front.
So another question that's come in, which I really like, is it hints at hope. Do we think that there is a real possibility that Parliament does not follow through with exiting the EU? At the moment, I think politicians have felt that the cost of challenging the wisdom of the popular vote politically is higher than the cost of leaving the EU and following that expression or perceived expression of the popular will. It remains to be seen whether that is still the case as we get embroiled in working out the detail and what it really means.
Perhaps a general election as well. I mean,
yeah.
If you return a government with a mandate that's been elected on a Remain vote, again, that goes back to my earlier point about whether or not you could revoke a withdrawal notice, is that the leaving of the European Union has to be done in accordance with the member state's constitution. Clearly, it could be deemed to be within one's constitution if the government of the day has been elected solely on a mandate to remain in the European Union. And so if that was the case, and we do face a general election shortly, which there's no reason why that cannot be ruled out at this stage, then there could be an about turn with the leave, bearing in mind that we still haven't yet, as of today, served our notice to leave, and we have a referendum result which is not binding in any way, and we have opinions from leading counsel in the UK that it's not binding. There's nothing in the EU Referendum Act of 2015 which set out when how this referendum should occur and when it should occur. There was nothing in that to indicate it's legally binding on Parliament, and that's the controversy at the moment, but it clearly does indicate the will of the people, but binding in nature only.
Yeah, I'd even, at least personally, query whether it really does indicate the will of the people. It was a 52-48 simple majority, representing less than half of the potential electorate, of the overall electorate, because, you know, not everybody voted, and it can be interpreted in various ways. So some commentators have said this was all about immigration. Other commentators have said, actually, this is all about stagnant incomes and disenchantment with mainstream politics and big business and globalization. The quality of the discussion around, you know, the pros and cons of actually remaining in the EU or leaving the EU and what leaving would mean was very, very poor during the campaign period.
So to answer the question, we're left with a UK Parliament that doesn't want to leave. We're left with a European Parliament that doesn't want the UK to leave. And we're left with some very much bare-bone treaty provisions for us to interpret where there is no precedent whatsoever. So, again, it's going to be interesting times.
So another question that we'd had from earlier was around residential markets. So the residential market has been thought to be undersupplied, creating the heated pricing in and around major markets. What's the anticipated income? What's the anticipated impact on the residential market, particularly development assets? So I'd say three things, I think. One is, as far as development, construction loans are concerned, actually, that's been a relatively challenging part of the market throughout the last few years. I mean, it's obviously much better than it was in 2010, 11, 12, but especially speculative projects have continued to find it relatively difficult to attract finance, both residential and commercial. Secondly, the part of the market that has been really hot and that stopped being really hot a little while ago, actually, is the luxury London market, the super prime London market aimed principally at the sort of internationally very wealthy. I think that clearly has taken a bit of a slowdown recently, and there's been concern about oversupply into that market and whether it's really robust.
And to be honest, from an economic point of view, as well as from an, you know, as far as the exposure of the of important parts of the UK economy and financial system to it are concerned, I don't think it's that important. The third point is the important one, which is that there is a chronic undersupply situation in housing, especially in London and the southeast of England, and there is no reason why any of this should have a significant impact on that. It could have a temporary impact, of course, particularly if the UK enters recession and, you know, people find it more difficult to borrow, find it more difficult to spend, face high risk of unemployment. But fundamentally, the mainstream residential market in the UK is just subject to the national economy in the normal way and certainly has those supply-demand dynamics that are supportive. And, of course, the UK is in a position where we are sort of still, as we have been for many years, on the cusp of finally having a proper grown-up multifamily sector. We haven't really got that. The rental market in residential property in the UK has historically been dominated by small private investors. It has not been a professional institutional market. We don't have any real residential multifamily REITs or other major funds, major investors.
You know, it's interesting, right, because dealing with that housing point, I mean, I heard people that had voted to leave saying that the reason they voted to leave is because they've been told that by the Remain campaign that if we were to vote to leave, then there could be a significant decline in house prices. And then you had young people that couldn't afford to get on the housing ladder said, if there's going to be a significant decline in house prices, then I want to benefit from that. So I'm going to vote to leave to get the house prices down so I can get onto the property ladder. So completely,
that's the kind of strategic thinking we need.
Yeah, so that's what we had. So on the housing, it's difficult. But I think on the prime resi, I would say that that's not a Brexit thing at all. There's a retrenchment of capital.
Yeah.
Based on commodity and oil issues at the back end of last year. I mean, I think I was talking to a real estate broker in Manhattan that said that his sales of 5 million plus apartments had gone from 70 a month to nearly 5 a month, 4 to 5 a month. So clearly that's nothing to do with Brexit. That's a retrenchment of capital from a market that many believed had become overpriced. But now with significant capital sitting on the sidelines, non-sterling capital, a weak pound, suddenly prices seem reasonable again. And I know of at least one prime resi fund that on the Friday after the Thursday, haven't faced numerous calls from Asia as to look at product again, raised a third fund. Specifically to raise capital for deploying against prime resi in the City of London. So it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, and I should also note that the Bank of England potentially lowering the base rate will have an effect on the mortgage rates that people will pay, and therefore that would buttress some of the values of houses, even if they take a hit in other respects. So availability of mortgages is high in the UK generally, and the mortgage rates even before the referendum were as low as they've ever been historically.
Did I say one of your notes, Mark, that debts, even the five-year swap rate, is down since the beginning of the year as well? So the cost of debt is lower than it's been for a long time.
It is remarkably low for a country with actually the negative rates for nominal interest rates are close to, sorry, the interest rates that are nominal are actually closer to zero, but the real rates, if you are asking an inflation expert what is the rate of interest in this country, it's actually negative 1.5. So if you compare the U.S. market to the U.K., factoring in inflation, the UK has negative yields already. All right, so that is just an amazing dynamic.
So, I've got two more questions. There's one that Andrew will take in a minute. That one's for Andrew, and one that I'll take now. So, one question that we've had earlier: does the market see risk that collateral values have declined in a way that may trip loan covenants or triggers? And I'm not going to answer that question precisely as it's posed, because as we've said, there's very little liquidity has been limited recently, and so it is very speculative at this stage. We don't really know exactly. We haven't got enough data. The point I did want to flag, though, is that in the financial stability report that the Bank of England published a few days ago, they've compared the extent to which the major UK banks are exposed to high LTV CRE lending to the extent to which other UK banks are exposed to high LTV CRE lending. So this is interesting just because the large banks are the ones, the major banks are the ones that are more systemically important. They're the ones that got a bit of a mauling during the financial crisis, and that the government has been especially focused on trying to nurse back to health. And the other ones are generally smaller ones that will be using the standardized approach rather than, well, no one's using internal models here. They're all on slotting, which I won't go into now. But they're the sort of challenger banks, the smaller banks, the specialist banks. A lot of them are focused on residential, but this chart ignores residential. And what it shows is that the major UK banks are overwhelmingly sensible in terms of the LTV levels that they're lending at. So it's somewhere around maybe 15% of the loan book, which is around 69 billion, according to the Bank of England, that major UK banks have of CRE. Only about 15% of that is at LTVs higher than 70%, and around 65% of that loan book is below 60%. If you look at other UK banks, which are the smaller ones and the challengers, the new ones, they in total represent around 17 billion, so 17 billion in the new banks compared to, and the small ones compared to 69 billion in the big ones. But of that 17, around 30% is at LTVs of more than 70%, and less than 60% is at less than 60%. So there's an interesting differential there with the big banks, which have a more risk-sensitive regulatory capital model, being skewed in more sensible directions as far as LTV is concerned. And LTV is the financial covenant most at risk at the moment, I would say, in the near term. It's not income covenants, it's LTV. So that seems to me to be reasonably encouraging, and I think that's the message that the Bank of England draws from it as well.
But Carney on Tuesday gave banks an extra $150 billion to lend.
Yeah, I'm not sure he did exactly that.
But the point is that they don't have anyone to lend it to at the moment either,
yeah.
Right? So the borrower demand isn't quite there. So what's the point of giving them extra lending power if no one actually wants to borrow it? And that's a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, aside from the current maelstrom affecting the open-ended funds and the slightly longer-term structural question around city offices, it seems to me that what we're likely to be seeing over the coming months and possibly longer is simply a much more selective approach, both to transactions from owners and to lending from lenders. People will just be more selective, more cautious, and won't just do things willy-nilly as they can do in a very hot market.
I'm very conscious of time, and I think I'll deal with this. We've got a number of questions we still haven't dealt with. I think if you can finish on that question, which is about actual pipeline and deals in the market, just very briefly, but I will talk about this one first, and I'll come back to you.
Okay.
So we've had a question in saying that from a time perspective, is it business as usual under the current EU agreements until the two-year period expires, or can the new agreements take effect earlier? It clearly is business as usual because we still remain a 28th member of this club, and everyone's very quick to point out the UK has still the obligations of EU law. We still have the rights, but clearly in practice it's not business as usual. I say that because our influence in Europe is already being removed. A number of MEPs on very important committees have been removed and replaced. So our MEPs are still in place. So whilst we do have all the rights and obligations under EU law, our influence in that is diminished greatly, and we do not face at the moment the same mentality as we used to before June 23rd. And I have one example of that with we act for a client, a local authority that was meant to be borrowing from the European Investment Bank. We signed a facility for a regeneration project within that local authority, purely the type of project that the EIB should be lending on. We had signed the facility. We went to draw it down because we hadn't drawn it down before the June the 23rd. Salina Council, local authority, said that they'd rather have the money in their pocket rather than the EIB's pocket, and the EIB refused to lend it to the UK local authority, citing the referendum vote. So that clearly does indicate that it's not business as usual. Whilst we do remain in the EU, so the quicker, in my view, the quicker we serve the notice and then get on with negotiations in a meaningful way, especially if we can withdraw that notice, the better.
Okay, and just to pick up this last point, which is just to give a flavour of transaction activity and what's happened both this year generally and especially since the vote. The Bank of England was already reporting that in the first quarter of this year, transaction volumes were down by about half compared to the first quarter of last year. I think the context is that the first quarter of last year was a massive quarter, so that shouldn't be taken as a sort of especially negative comment. The publication I've kept referring to from a few days ago also says that foreign investors accounted for around 45% of the value of total transactions in UK commercial real estate since 2009, but that these inflows fell by almost 50% in the first quarter of 2016. So that's interesting as well in terms of the mix between domestic and overseas capital coming into the UK CRE market. In terms of the Brexit vote, anecdotally in our Board of Advisors meeting last week, I think, quite a few people were talking. There was a lot of discussion around Brexit clauses in loan agreements or pre-loan agreements. So a lot of negotiations that had reached a relatively advanced phase included a provision that allowed a party to withdraw if depending on the outcome of the vote. Some of those were exercised. Plenty weren't, or were sort of semi-exercised with a view to repricing and renegotiation of aspects of the terms. Many people in our meeting sounded like they were presenting that as a good thing, that deals were still happening, in the sense that deals that had almost been sealed and delivered didn't crater completely, but were seen through. And I think the bigger question is what happens to the pipeline, what happens to new deals. And on that, we've had JLL reporting that around 11% of its pipeline of UK deals was withdrawn in the immediate aftermath of the Brexit vote. There's a bit more detail. I don't know whether you wanted to highlight any of the numbers here, Andrew.
Yeah, so 11% that with withdrawn, but that actually says the majority of deals, 60%, remain unchanged and are yet to see an effect. So people are not rushing into decision making. As we said at the top of the call, this is the first of a multi-event process which will be played out over the coming months. So I don't think people are immediately rushing to pull deals. I think there are certain deals that were very specific to the vote, and they have been pulled, but 11% is not a great number. And it says that JLL's view is approximately 40% of UK deals have already reacted to Brexit and have not changed, but there might be a slight price renegotiation. But as much as £15 billion in live and planned UK CRE deals are still to react as at the date of the report just a few days ago. But obviously, as Peter mentioned, these are fast-moving times. Before that, when that report was published, we didn't have any open-end funds that had locked up their assets. Now we have 10. So, even by the end of this call, things could have changed again. It just literally is moving hour by hour.
And one last comment, actually. We haven't really talked about the REIT market. The REIT market has taken a complete battering as well, performing much, much worse than the FTSE index, the FTSE all-share index. There's one particular analyst, Jefferies, called Mike Prue. He's always very, very negative about the REITs, actually. I'm not quite sure how he keeps going, but he's on the record as saying that he expects £3 to £5 billion worth of CRE assets to be put up for sale fairly imminently because of the battering that the sector is taking. I don't know. To my mind as well, you'd have thought that some of the UK REITs are trading at such massive discounts to net asset value.
I think
that they surely
told me the land sec is 40% down.
Yeah. I mean, they must present pretty interesting
acquisition opportunities
at the moment, because yes, anticipating market fall, value falls is probably sensible, but at that degree, I think is
I don't understand why North American capital, for anyone on this call, would not be looking at that in a very very close way at the moment, because that must be very much a good strategic buy at the moment.
So we've tried to end on a positive note, sort of.
There are opportunities,
yeah.
But it really is watch this space.
Okay. So thank you very much to Mark and Andrew. I hope we've answered most of the questions that we got. I hope people found that interesting and useful. I don't know whether there's a feedback facility, but it'd be good to receive any feedback, because, as we said at the beginning, it's very much the intention to do an event in New York to follow up at a time in the autumn when there's a little bit more evidence and facts for us to talk about, and a little bit less sort of speculation and worry, which is still where we are at the moment. So thank you all very much. We'll sign off there.
Thank you.